He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think.
This is the School of Motion podcast. Come for the MoGraph, stay for the puns.
It's taken a very long time for digital art to gain that or be on the same playing field in terms of the paradigm of what's respected and what's not, right? And that's had a huge turning point, I think, in the last 2 years. And it's been amazing to see, like, just the fact that you can put work out there into the world and people respond to it so much that they're like, hey, like, we just love what you do. Like, can you do a version for us, you know?
Ridley Scott, David Fincher, Mark Romanek. And now, add to that list, Shane Griffin, who Motioneers, you're about to hear so much about the journey and process of what it's like to be someone who lives in the world of motion design, but also directs for companies like maybe this one you've heard of, Apple. That's right. We have the director of the most recent Apple Mac M1 Max launch commercial talking to us all about his journey and what the process is like working as a motion designer who also gets to step on set and make some pretty amazing projects. But right before that, let's tell you a little bit about School of Motion from one of our amazing alumni.
Hi, how are you doing today? My name is Stephen Jenkins. I'm a School of Motion alumni. I've been working with After Effects since about 2003, when I first picked up a book and started playing with it and started learning how to use the wiggle expression, different keyframes. And one thing I always avoided was the graph editor. And I really feel bad that I waited so long to take one of these courses so that I could learn how to use it. Once I learned how to use the graph editor, it just demystified how to make things move. It was just, I still am just amazed at what they've taught me here at the School of Motion. I plan on staying with School of Motion for a long time. It's been amazing. Again, my name is Stephen Jenkins and I'm a School of Motion alumni.
Motioneers, we talk about animation all the time. We talk about our tools all the time. But one thing we don't really talk often that much is the crossroads of where live action and motion design meet. It's a huge opportunity. And it's something that back in the early days, when we called motion design MoGraph, everybody was playing with this. But as motion design has grown up and started to solidify around Cinema 4D and After Effects, it's a skill set or a tool set a lot of us have lost or haven't really learned. I want to bring someone on that could help us reconnect a little bit with this idea of live action and VFX and all these other tools still being part of motion design. And honestly, there's no one better to bring in than Shane Griffin. You may have seen him as Mr. Griff or Griff Studio, but I can guarantee you saw some of his newest work. If you saw the newest promo video for the Mac Pro, the M1 Max, you've seen his work. Shane Griffin, let's talk about everything that you do in your career.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Thank you so much. I mentioned just a little bit at the beginning, but when I found out that you were the genius behind this commercial, I started diving into all of your work. And it really made me excited because you feel like a throwback to what was exciting about motion graphics when I was getting started. The only person I could really think about comparing you to was you feel like a modern version of what I used to see when G-Monk was just getting started. He was playing around with all kinds of new tools. He was mixing live action and motion design. And there just was this really amazing kind of curiosity that was really informed by art and design and just a cinematographic look at the world. How did you get started? How did you get to the point where Apple taps you on the shoulder and says, we need what you've got?
Oh, that's quite a journey and a great question. So interesting that you say that because we're probably around the same age, probably came up at the same time with this. And my story starts way back when I just finished, I guess, the equivalent of high school. I'm Irish, by the way, so I'm from, you know, Europe. We have a slightly different system there. But so I finished, I guess, the equivalent of high school when I was around 18. And I wanted to be an architect. And I had applied for architecture and all that sort of stuff. And I missed it by 5 points, which is five points out of 600, right? Which is less than 1%, right? So my two best friends at the time, you know, they had applied and they got it. They actually still work together to this day, actually. So I had applied for it. I missed it. And they wouldn't let me compensate with a portfolio or anything.
Oh, wow.
And I was pretty pissed off. So I didn't really know what to do. And I was yeah, I had been, you know, tinkering around on Photoshop and Apple Motion at the time and doing a load of, you know, just trying to do album covers for people and whatever else I was doing in my teenage years. And my brother was working in a company that was kind of doing sales for a lot of post-production, you know, hardware, software stuff. So he kind of knew the industry, but he wasn't in it. He was doing sales for, like, you know, different things. But long story short, he used to work in a DVD magazine, if you remember them. There was this magazine back home called, I think it was called Enter or something. He was working, I don't know what he was doing there, but he was working there with this guy who was taking care of doing the DVD menus and all the design, all the graphic stuff for it. And that guy had randomly come up to the, I remember he drove up to the house on a little Vespa and he was inviting my brother to his wedding. And they got into a conversation. He said, "Oh, what are you doing these days?" He's like, "Oh, well, I work in this post-production place." And he said, "Oh, my brother's trying to get a job because he doesn't know what he's going to do with his life." and he said, he looked at some of the stuff I was making. He's like, "Oh, you know, you kind of know what you're doing for a kid. So, you know, why don't you come in?" So I went in as his kind of intern and I got in there and there was only two guys in the graphics department. One of them was using Maya. The other one was using Soft Image. John, who was using Maya, who'd got me in there, I was expecting him to teach me the ropes. I get in there. He doesn't talk to me for once for about 3 months. Swear to God. So it was up to this other guy, Steven, and he started teaching me how to use After Effects because I used Apple Motion and familiar with Photoshop, Illustrator and stuff. And he was teaching me the ropes and he was really teaching me, like, he was teaching me how to get in and get out at 6 o'clock. Right. He was teaching me all of the sneaky back doors around doing stuff. And we were doing really the bottom of the barrel of the commercials in a town that didn't really, you know, have many commercials. So I was just learning, really just learning the tools as I was going. And I began to really enjoy it because, like, I always had an interest in, like, tech and computers, things like that. And I was an artistic kid. So, you know, it felt like I could kind of use the two of them at the same time and always enjoy learning stuff. So it was, I was having fun and I was beginning to see a lot of what the American companies were doing at the time. And this is for me, the kind of golden era of motion design, you know, when it was like, there was really amazing studios putting out some really amazing stuff. And I just couldn't believe that it was done with the same tools that I had in front of me. You know, I was like, no, there's got to be some other secret sauce in here, you know?
Right.
And probably some of the best ones there. I mean, like Shiloh. And
I was about to say Shiloh. Literally, that was the first one.
And PsyOff as well. And, you know, there were so many great things happening. And I began to build a little bit of a reel for myself, whatever that was at the time. And I ended up moving to another studio in Dublin then who were more on the lookout for, you know, like a designer, like a proper motion designer. And I start, you know, they were using XSI as well. And that's what that other guy, Steven, had been teaching me a little bit of. So I was trying to use 3D where I could. And I kind of took the seed of, do you know Steven Kelleher?
Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing, amazing, amazing designer. He was working in this company at the time and he had just left to go to the States. And I kind of took his seed over. And, you know, big shoes to fill at the time, especially as a young'un. Yeah, so I worked there for a few years. And that's where I began to kind of find a voice for myself, I guess. Like, I was really, I became kind of more interested in the 3D side of things, you know, using 3D as a design tool rather than, because that really wasn't a thing back then. I'm sure you remember, like, you know, the only thing you'd have is like a couple of random shapes with ambient occlusion on them. And then, like, you know, so a lot of After Effects on top.
Yeah. I mean, you can pour one out for XSI right now, if you're listening. I mean, that was my first 3D tool coming out of school, and you're right. It was super powerful, but it was not geared for the kinds of stuff we think of when we think of motion design now.
Yeah. And it was a shame it got discontinued because it really was an incredible piece of kit. But yeah, so I got really interested in learning a bit more about photorealism and things like that. So I went to work at an effects company in Dublin who were also doing commercials and they needed a designer, but they were beginning to kind of ramp up to do more film effects. Their first big gig was Game of Thrones season 1.
Wow.
But at the time I had moved there and I had done some bits and bobs, and I was learning V-Ray at the time in 3D Max, and, you know, trying to understand a bit more about photorealism with that. And that was all going quite well. So anyway, after being there for a couple of years, they started branching more into effects, and we did a movie. And then I was doing I had this terrible gig actually at one point where I was doing effects on a film with Daniel Radcliffe in it. And he was dressed, I think he was like a Nazi or something, or I can't remember. I didn't ever watch the film, but he had this giant zit on his head and I had to track it out of all the shots.
Right.
And I was thinking, man,
this is my life.
This is a waste of time. Yeah. So that really kind of lit the fire. And I thought, man, I need to, you know, respectfully, I love the guys and we had a great working relationship, but I was like, I need to get out of here and try and follow my, you know, where I think the industry is going. So at that point I got in touch with Man vs. Machine, who were in London, you know, they were a small shop at the time. Obviously they're really big now, but at the time there was maybe four guys there, and I went over and met them and I said, hey, you know, here's kind of what I'm doing. And they're like, yeah, it seems like a fit. Like, let's do it. And they were using Mental Ray at the time. Oh my God. So yeah, so I went to London then, and I worked with those guys for a couple of years. We got to work on some really interesting stuff. And I think that's when, you know, I had a lot of pent up design things ready to come out of me, you know? So I was really firing on all cylinders in my mid-20s. I was like, you know, let's do this, you know. Mm-hmm. All these things I learned in VFX and stuff was like, let's get this into, you know, let's bring this into motion design. This.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of amazing studios doing similar things at that time as well. And that was kind of like the second golden era, I think, for motion design. So, and just being really consumed by it then, and I really began to kind of fall in love with what we could really do and achieve. And you know, I mean, community wise, like, I really saw that, like, the sky was the limit with this stuff, and it was really going to take over. And I thought, you know, I need to think about how to combine this with live action and get into directing stuff from that point of view. And really, you know, kind of learning at that point that when you're involved, if you're doing a piece that has a lot of heavy involvement with design and effects, you really need to be at the helm of a project rather than be, you know, somebody who's executing after the mm-hmm. fact, because there's a lot of experience disconnect across, well, less so now, but at the time, certainly with, you know, traditional live action directors, with VFX companies and then designers, you know, mm-hmm. and there wasn't really, everybody was kind of not really communicating so well. So I was like, all right, maybe I should take a step back and try to get involved and direct in live action and then begin to, you know, combine all these things that I've learned from effects side of things, from design side of things, and try this new avenue and see what happens.
That's great. Yeah. I feel like at that time there was a big kind of what I call like a head versus hands rivalry.
Right.
Yeah. There were people who were like, stand back. We're shooting, we're thinking, we're doing it. And when we need you, we'll tap you on the shoulder and you just figure it out. You're the hands, you execute. But there wasn't that collaboration. There wasn't that understanding of, from CDs or live action, how to approach a shoot with VFX in mind. It was just like, well, you'll figure it out later.
Exactly. And it becomes a very specific skill set to have then. And, you know, the projects that you get tend to really need your expertise in every instance. Then sometimes you become the only person who can do the job, for better or worse,
right?
Because sometimes you're trying to branch out and do other things and they're like, no, you do this effects-y job. Mm-hmm. But you know, all that I think is I explained it to a friend recently, is it feels like kind of like a game of chess, and you're just mm-hmm. you're moving these pieces to kind of set yourself up for the bigger picture jobs. And that's the way it felt for me. I was kind of moving these pieces in design and doing a lot of my own, you know, 3D projects and getting better in that area, while also kind of doing a lot more live action commercial work. And, you know, there's a natural blend of effects between those two anyway.
Yeah.
And I felt like, you know, the more that I pushed the 3D and design portion of things, the more I was learning about like the technical side of 3D more and more. So yeah, it all kind of, it feels like everything I learned benefits the other side of the spectrum one way or another, you know?
I love seeing that because I feel like there's probably a lot of people listening to this that are wondering, you know, it's a black box for a lot of motion designers, how to make that bridge into whether it's creative direction or live action directing without completely forsaking everything that got them to that point. And when I look at your work, when I look at your Instagram, or I want to talk a little bit more about your site, I really feel this like call and response between the work you do, what you call commissions, and then the personal explorations you do, what you call artwork on your website. They feel like a unified whole. They feel like they inform each other. Whereas I've seen a lot of people make a similar jump, and that personal kind of vision and look kind of disappears as I start getting into the directing or creative directing field where they're responding to clients and they're kind of just giving them what they want. Have you actively managed that? Or like, look, I'm going to make my own stuff because I need to know what I need to offer in this other realm? Or did it just kind of happen on accident?
I think that there's definitely a point of view that I've got with commercial work and with personal work, of course, but a lot of it has become this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where you have an idea, you put it out into the world and people respond to it. So there's always this sense of I'm trying to, you know, throw this lasso out into the world to drag in projects with this vision in mind, you know, like, so this kind of started a couple of years ago when I created my Chromatic series. And I was trying to, this is pre-NFT days. This is really pre-people even like in digital art days around 2016. Yeah, so I was throwing out this kind of lasso to the world to try and, you know, rope in a project, rope in a big commission. And the funny thing about doing that project, I had great fun doing it. And it was great to explore this idea that was always in my mind, you know. What ended up happening is I was sharing a studio with some friends at the time. And I created what became the kind of, I guess, master image of that series. And I called the guys around to my desk. I said, hey, check out this thing I just made. And they were like, wow, what is it? You know, I was like, oh, I'm not too sure. But I had put an Apple logo over it in Photoshop, and I clicked the layer on and I clicked it off, and I started laughing, you know?
Right.
Funny that I put that out into the world, because a year later they bought the image for the iPhone. Amazing. Screen.
Right.
And when that weird thing happened where I was like, I think I'm making this for something, but I'm making it for myself. But mm-hmm. I think I'm making it for something else as well, or I have a destination for this thing in mind. It kind of manifested itself into the real world, which was very bizarre.
I love that you say that, because there's a bit of a theme over the last probably 3 or 4 podcasts I've been recording where there's this underlying surface of everyone in the last year or so seems to be waking up in the middle of the morning straight up and saying, you know, no matter what I call myself, no matter what I tell my parents when they ask what I do, animator, motion designer, creative director, there has been a stark realization that basically we all work in advertising. And sadly, that's what motion design in some ways has been kind of like defined by. But in the last year, and I really look at your work as a really good indication of this, whether it's because of personal projects or NFTs or just people being interested in digital art, the paradigm's been flipped exactly with like what you said. Everybody's doing their own things and kind of making some stuff and kind of sheepishly posting on Instagram or doing something. But the moment you put a logo over the top of your artwork, something that you don't even know exactly where it came from or what it's intended to be, but you're following your voice, your vision, your obsessions, it feels like advertising is now coming to artists for art rather than saying, hey, here's what we need, go do it. And I'm just like, I really think people should look at your artwork section on your site and scroll through, because you can see so many examples of this happening, right? Like the Chromatic stuff, the Yeezy, where you're doing a lot of things where you're mixing either textiles or fashion with, it's interesting you said, like a very architectural point of view. And now you're starting to see brands say, oh, can we get a little bit of your heat? Instead of saying, hey, come to our heat. It feels like there's this huge paradigm shift potentially in motion design. And you're sitting like right at like the moment with your work.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I do feel that too. I mean, I think a lot of the jobs that I was lucky enough to get this year have been collaborations, you know, where mm-hmm. they're kind of like, hey, we love what you do and we just want you to kind of, you know, do something for us and we'll pay you for it, you know?
That's the dream.
That was really never the case before, you know, like mm-hmm. someone it's taken a very long time. Illustrators, sure, photographers, sure, but it's taken a very long time for digital art to gain that or be on the same playing field in terms of the paradigm of what's respected and what's not, right?
Right.
And that's had a huge turning point, I think, in the last 2 years. And it's been amazing to see, like, just the fact that you can put work out there into the world and people respond to it so much that they're like, hey, like, we just love what you do. Like, can you do a version for us, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, that's just kind of where I've been aiming to bring that work for a number of years. And I've always felt a bit like, geez, why do I see, I mean, all respect you to amazing illustrators, but sometimes I, you know, there'll be a clothing brand and they do a collaboration and the illustrator's name is all over it. And they're like, you know, and I was like, cool, that seems like a great collaboration. What, you know, why don't 3D artists have that? Or,
yeah,
you know, so I've been really trying to fight that, the good fight of that for years and get in there and make it a respected thing. And it's really beginning to happen now for a lot of people. So it's a great time. And it's great that mindset has been shifted to where it is now.
I think the word you use that's really important is mind shift, because it's not just our clients, you know, that are shifting their minds. It's really us as motion designers, as 2D animators, 3D animators, that like the work we do has value beyond our day rate or how long we're going to stay in on the weekend to get something done. There's actually real true value. And I look back and I think like it's almost like the arc of what happened with rap or hip hop music, where it was a thing, the people who liked it, but there was almost a little bit of shame with it compared to all the other like readily established music genres, right? And then someone took a chance and applied that to like an ad, or Run-DMC and Aerosmith put out a song where like everybody all of a sudden realizes the value. And then now we're living in a world where rap artists are putting shoes out that are like the most highly collectible items. And like every time that happens, I'm constantly saying like motion designers are literally making the work that brands are using. Why hasn't it reversed yet? And it's exciting to see that maybe it's because of technology, maybe it's because of the hype around NFTs, but really it's because people like you have been out there making the work, playing around, thinking of things that a client would never ask you for in the first place. But now that they see it, they want it. They need it. They have to have it.
I thought of it this the other day in the terms of like music, right? It's like, what's the parallel between art and design and music? And I think it's like, remember maybe 10 years ago, all right, if you look at the Coachella lineup from 15 years ago, there's probably not an electronic music act in the headline area, right? Maybe Daft Punk, but probably not many others. If you look at it now, it's probably majority DJs, right?
Yep.
And at some point there was a mind shift where people were like, oh, I don't mind if it's electronic, you know? And I think that that's kind of like a similar switch that will happen with the art space and digital art space, is that like at some point, yeah, sure, there's still going to be this kind of snobbery to it. But for the most part, people will be like, oh, okay, it's a digital art piece. That's fine.
Yeah.
And I think that will just begin to blend out in the way that, you know, music events, you know, no one really thought of it. But you did touch on a good point earlier on about like, you know, the people's work being worth more than their day rate or whatever, or, you know, work in general, like what is the value of it? And I think that there's been this conditioning from the industry to say that your work is worth X, you know? Mm-hmm. If you go back to Renaissance era where everybody was painting, I'm sure that there was probably some sort of a day rate situation going on there too. But the, you know, for all the people who interned and whatnot, but like there was patrons.
Yes.
The patronage was part of the culture of art, I guess. And I think that that's what the NFTs has kind of flipped, you know, to kind of get rid of this idea of cost conditioning of work and, you know, your stuff is not worth this and XYZ. And it's a good conversation to have, for better or worse. If some things are overvalued, some things are undervalued, whatever, it's a good conversation to have. And it's good that people are beginning to, you know, take risks for themselves and say, no, I think my work is this good and I think it is worth this. And that's great to see. And it's great that there is an audience out there that appreciate this, you know?
Yeah. And it's only going to accelerate. Like I was having a conversation with someone who used to work with the studio that Beeple was a director, creative director, art director at. And he remembers the moment where he got on a Zoom meeting early this year. I was like, oh, where's Mike? And like, oh, Mike's not coming back. And he wasn't really aware of the NFT scene at the time, this producer I was talking to. And he was like, he started doing the research and he was like, oh my God. He's like, this guy's done just from his two major sales, right? The initial, whatever it was, $60, $70 million. And then this recent Christie's one, he's done $100 million in two fine art sales, two auctions, not even considering all the other revenue and the secondary sales and whatever which might come. If you just start trying to apply that to like the lifetime amount of value he's generating for his collectors and for anybody else who's, you know, Christie's and everything, just off of those two sales alone, he's creating like literally several billion dollars worth of lifetime value for himself and the people who have collected him. That's mind-blowing to understand for a motion designer who people loved and people, you know, would go and line up at NAB and watch him talk, but no one ever considered the value of his work and the kind of fascination and the cult of personality that he's created. Like that wasn't even possible. And now at every level of scale, you know, you might be selling some Tezos, you know, bits of artwork for $4 and build enough fandom to support yourself. Or you can go after the lottery ticket. Last year, we were just arguing about why haven't day rates gone up from what they've been for the last 10 years. The conversation has completely changed. It's amazing.
I mean, people's story is so inspirational. You know, it really is. It's so cool. I remember hearing about his first sales this month last year was what got me into NFTs. It was like, he sold how much on the weekend? I was like, I've got 10 years worth of work I'm sitting on here. I think he kind of blew the door open for everyone, you know? He's like the people's champ.
I think the thing that's interesting about him, though, is that you can say whatever you want about the work, right? And this is what's great about when you start walking into the fine art world, is that like that's the conversation. And we don't have that conversation very often about our work. You know, our work is so ephemeral. Before you're almost finished making it, it's almost done and gone. You know, it's out in the world. And 3 days later, even if it took you a month to make it, the world's seen it and they've crumpled it up and thrown it away. But the thing I find really interesting about Beeple is it's the story that's told about him, almost more so than the work. It's this guy did how many images for how many days, for how many years? How did he do that? You know, like that cult of personality is what I think is so interesting. And it makes me wonder, you know, like you mentioned, you did some artwork. Apple said, hey, can we buy it? How did that happen? And then how does that extrapolate itself into you make this amazing announcement video for the Mac that everybody's been waiting for in our industry, right? There's a great exodus away from PC back to Mac. You're sitting in the driver's seat for that. How does that happen? How do you get the tap on your shoulder? What story did you have to tell to get there?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, let me set it up so that in case anybody's listening, they understand that there's other factors involved that's not just getting handpicked right for these things. So with these larger form projects where there's, it's called a black project, right? So everyone's on a need to know basis in the project. So it's a new product. So, you know, not everybody on the job is allowed to see the product. A lot of people, you know, the first time I actually saw the product was on set, you know, so I didn't even see it prior, and even any images prior to being on set.
Wow.
You know, so everything's very locked down and secure, and you know, you get a security briefing every morning and none of the computers can be connected to the internet. So in order to get a job like that, you have to have like a certification, a security audit, essentially from, in this case, Apple, but you would have to have one for any other brand if you're doing like a big launch like this. And then you also have to have the flexibility of a big team and know that you can, there's so many other factors involved, but these are just the main ones, you know.
Right.
You have to have a big enough pipeline to make sure that everything can fit through. So, you know, there's only a certain amount of companies that are going to be called for a job like that. My rep is PsyOp. I love PsyOp, and they are my homies, and they really are a special place to be. And they got contacted about the job for me. We went through a pretty rigorous pitching process against a lot of really good directors, which is very scary. And they know who they built the machine for. You know, they built the machine for our industry. They built it for people like you and I. And I think even though all the directors that were pitching on the job weren't necessarily from our background and had our experiences, I think the fact that I did was kind of what got me the competitive edge in that pitch.
Right.
Because I you know, I have my ear to the ground, relatively speaking, with, you know, motion design and people who are GPU rendering, you know, real-time things, blah, blah, blah. And when we began to concept the job, like I was putting in some ideas. I was like, well, you know, this is tech move. This is futuristic and this is going to be big next year. So why don't we try do a bit of this? And, you know, this is where I've had issues in the past. And I think that, you know, if the thing really performs this well, it's going to look great if we do a little bit of this. And I think, you know, embedding all those ideas into the pitch, I think that you felt like, you know, I was the right person to helm the ship, you know?
Yeah.
But it really came down to a number of things. Like, why was it me? I think it was experience, certainly having experience in live action and having shot for Apple before definitely helped. And, you know, from a design point of view, I think my sensibilities are in line with what they're thinking, you know, moving forward. Obviously, I've done the wallpapers and I, you know, there was just a lot of synergy from all sides of the spectrum there, you know, and I think they wanted to have somebody who was equally as invested in making it amazing as they were, you know. Mm-hmm. So we got on the phone after the first initial pitch and a lot of the ideas that we had for that were changed a bit, conceptually speaking, like the kind of conceptual thread that we were weaving through everything was changed, essentially. And it went more down a monstrous route, mm-hmm. which was quite interesting. So, you know, I rewrote a lot of the concept to revolve around monsters. Yeah, I was very shocked that it got green lit, to be honest.
Yeah, they never actually say the word beast, but while you watch it, it's screaming at the entire time, right? Like the whole time I'm watching is like, okay, I'm looking at the stats as they pop up. I'm watching this very man versus machine like assembly of the actual hardware itself, which it's so funny that you mentioned you used to work there because I was like, this is so different from the way Apple would normally show something off. But then, like you said, you see all these larger than life creatures and you see the mocap and you see all these moments. It's very, very Blade Runner-esque kind of DJ rave scene that I just like, yeah. I wanted to stand up and cheer. And I'm not like an Apple like person. I can go either way.
Yeah.
But it just felt like this really big like call to arms celebration, extending the hand back out from Apple to like, hey, we never forgot about you. We had to make something for you. We're ready. Come to us. And it could have been more perfect the way it was laid out.
Thanks. Yeah. No, funny enough, you say the hand thing. That was the original end shot. The giant projection was going to reach the hand out. So yeah, no, I thought that would have been a nice little metaphor, but lost that battle. Yeah, like they were really interested in pushing away from the kind of typical white psych look and feel. And they wanted to really show that this is more of an, you know, it's a heavier product than they've done before. It's a thicker product than they've done before. It's engineered a lot more aggressively and a lot more industrial, you know. So there was a lot of aesthetics around the actual device that we were trying to instill into the motion language of what we were making, you know, which is actually kind of not on trend right now, which is great.
Yeah.
So we were looking at a lot of different formation sequences. Like we looked at a lot of the Marvel stuff, the Iron Man stuff coming together, and it was kind of cool, but wasn't exactly right. And then there were some other things. I was like, it needs to have this element of organic nature with an element of robotic nature, you know? And one thing I wanted to do with that assembly thing that you mentioned at the beginning was I didn't want any piece to just turn on from nowhere. Like everything had to come from something, fold out from something, be motivated by something. So a lot of anytime I do anything, I drill really hard on the motivation, you know. It's like, where is the motivation of this thing emanating from? Like what's its kind of core source of power? And luckily it was easy to kind of anchor that metaphor on the chip, because it was all about the chip, the M1X.
Right.
So it was a really conceptually easy thing to build on, having the chip as this kind of source of power, you know.
I really feel like people should just clip out just that section where the chip starts growing and things start assembling, because I think it's a masterclass in stuff we try to talk about in School of Motion all the time. We talk about theme and tone and like desired response, and how both your design and your animation language choices can inform that. And I'm so excited to watch it just over and over, because there are so many of those elements of what you just talked about, right? You talked about the organic, but you talked about like the kind of feeling like it's machined or robotic. And like, there's so many little bits of organic movement, but then when the machine starts to build itself, it snaps. It moves in a very like linear fashion. I couldn't help but just look at like, this is really sophisticated beyond just being beautifully rendered. Every single moment, the almost isometric camera views, as it starts growing, supports the fact that it's all these right angles. And then even just like every little piece, the way it pops and scales and moves, it feels like someone handcrafted every keyframe and paid attention to it, which with these pressures, with as many other shots and sequences you have to do, it's almost 2 minutes long. It's amazing that somebody could take that much time and spend that much attention to detail at something that reinforces what the rest of the piece is going to be about. I really think it's really brilliant the way it's put together.
Thanks. That means a lot, because there was a huge team of people really grinding themselves on this one. So the animation team were amazing. And I think even though, with a lot of these things, if you have an animation team and you give them a reference to something, they can copy it. And I was like, right, whatever we do, we will not copy a single thing. This whole thing is going to be fresh,
Yeah.
So I started with the idea of, again, trying to always anchor this thing on it being 50-50 organic and 50-50, robotic, and kind of, felt like it came from this organic place. So with this assembly at the beginning, I had this idea of having this kind of light shard coming to screen, and you see it in the intro sequence. And what was quite interesting is I was shooting with Darius Wolski, who shot amazing DB. For anyone listening who doesn't know him, he shot like Prometheus, The Martian, a lot of amazing. He just did House of Gucci. Amazing guy.
He's a very often Ridley Scott collaborator.
Yes. He actually left to go and shoot Napoleon with Ridley the day after. So we were kicking around some ideas for how to create this interesting light cone. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, instill some of my chromatic thinking in there as well. So we were on set and we were trying a bunch of these different light things. And I was like, no, nothing's really working well. And I pulled the art director aside and I said, hey, can you send some runners to go and find some Fresnel sheets? And he's like, I don't even know what they are. I was like, Darius, do you know what a Fresnel sheet is? He's like, no. I was like, does anyone in this production know what a Fresnel sheet is? They were like, no. I was like, well, go and get 20 of them, right? They came back. They found like a 14-inch Fresnel sheet. We put it on the light and boom, we had this incredibly, ethereal light cone with all the beautiful chromatic breakup on the edges and stuff. And it just worked out amazing.
And you're getting it in camera on the day in the scene. You're not trying to get it later.
Exactly. Yeah. And I, cause I really didn't want to augment anything later.
Yeah.
And then when it moves into the crystal formation, I became kind of Ed Chu, who is an amazing motion designer who worked on this. I was like, Ed, I want to make this crystal like thing and it's going to be a real headache. And I'm sorry in advance. I have an obsession with these bismuth crystals, which are like these angular crystals, which kind of look like architectural in form. Yep. And I was like, how can we make this bismuth crystal thing come to life? Yeah, like every day he was just grinding. It was getting better and better and better. And eventually he created this, really beautiful system for the bismuth, which kind of revealed itself as the chip. So it had a lot of these, great kind of conceptual moments leading up to this one chip build. And this is only in the first kind of, 20 seconds or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just kind of goes back to the idea of like everything is anchored around this conceptual thing that has to have relevance in the real world somehow. Otherwise I find it really, really hard to get behind design for design's sake or like motion for motion's sake. Mm-hmm. Once you have this kind of core concept and this core like motivating factor, then it's so easy to rationalize what you do from there on.
I mean, I love that. That's why I always say theme first, right? Especially when you're working with a client who says, I just want something beautiful. That's a box that's very wide. It's almost like not even a box. It's just an amorphous blob that can change all the time. But when you have at least one parameter that you can point everyone to and be like, look, this has to at least approach this conflict, like organic versus rigid, whatever, it lets you, it's weird how this happens. Having those parameters lets you be more flexible on the smaller decisions. Like you said, like I almost feel like I need to apologize to the podcast listeners now because I'm sitting here as a fan talking to you, but I have so many questions about that because you're working with Darius. You're working with somebody who's, I mean, their line of things they've worked on is insane. How trepidatious or like concerned are you on the day working on this very important thing for Apple? I'm assuming there are representatives from Apple there somewhere to just on the fly ask for something that, like you said, nobody even knew what it was or had the answer right away. How rigid do you have to be when you're on set? Or, you know, is there a lot of room? Do you have that much trust to be able to be like, hey, Darius, I know you're the DP, you're world class, but I have this idea. Do you feel like you have a limited number of shots on the day that you can kind of experiment or try? And do you have to check that in with, you know, your clients? Or are you just given the freedom to go? People trust you. You've given the brief. They know what you're going for. And they let you have it.
I think with a job like this, where there's quite a lot at stake in terms of, you know, there's no room for error with something like this. You know, there's no room for, in terms of like timeline as well, right? Because you're against the clock and you're working up to an event. For instance, you know, I think we finished the film the Saturday night and it went live on the Tuesday.
Ooh, tight.
You know, in commercial world, that's unheard of.
Yeah.
You're delivering 2 weeks in advance. So, you know, there is definitely a lot of pressure on that. But I think the best way to approach anything like that is just good channels of communication, you know, having a good relationship with the DP, having a good relationship with the first AD and a good relationship with the client. I mean, it's very hard to have that.
Right.
I will say specifically on this project, we really did have great communication across the board. So even when we were experimenting and trying new things and trying shots that weren't boarded, the client were very good and very trusting. And, you know, once you kind of are able to explain to them why we're going to try and do this and what it, how it's going to benefit us and where it could potentially go in the edit, I think everyone's up for it.
That's great.
It's very rare that you'd be able to just keep shooting for shooting's sake. I don't think I've ever been in a project where I've wrapped early. I can wrap on time,
yeah,
but I rarely wrap early. There's always a different spin you can put on things. So
yeah. Well, that I think that's what motion designers a little bit lose out on by having to be constrained to the box and what the tools can do, at least in the modern version of what motion design is there's not room for happy accidents and discovery that, you know, on the day, a world-class DP, an awesome art director, red team, you can carve out 15, 20 minutes to try something when everybody knows what they're doing and the rest of the parameters are set. Mm. That's really hard to do in a motion design environment. It's something I wish we had, honestly, more opportunities for people.
Yeah, I guess the difference in when you're so heavily in motion design and you're so heavily detail orientated, right? The second you put a camera out on set, all the details are there. Right. All the details free.
Yeah.
So you really have to take your hat off, like that motion design hat off or whatever you're, you know, if you're a technical director or whatever, you really have to take that hat off and you're like, okay, this is details are free. Physics is free.
Yeah. Light just happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Light just happens. So now we have to focus on story and now we have to focus on making sure that the flow is consistent and things are cutting nicely. And the one benefit that I've tried to have more on set with me is an editor. Having an editor on set is
awesome.
Amazing. Yeah. And it begins to feel a lot more like you're in your 3D previs and you're, you know, trying stuff in After Effects and you're chopping shots together. If you can have your editor on set with you, you can nearly do a lot of that in real time. And sometimes you'll come out at the end of the day and you might even have half your commercial cut together, you know? So when we left and PSYOP were supplying a lot of the previs to the editor, we were trying stuff and we were assembling shots together and trying exactly as we had boarded and trying some alternatives and whatnot. And by the time we left on the, whatever, the fourth day, yeah, we had something, you know?
Yeah.
We were like, wow, it's going to work. Now, it didn't look like the end product, but, you know, it at least gave us an indication to know that
Because you're never really sure if it's going to work.
No. it's amazing. I wish people really understood how much almost everything you see on TV, on a film, on your phone is a little miracle that it all hangs together once it gets put on a timeline and some music thrown to it. Because the leap of faith you have to take as a director and how long you have to sustain that leap of faith is kind of stunning and actually shocking that people have full-term careers, because the amount of anxiety you have to learn it to manage as a creative director or a live action director. Like I've sat with Guillermo del Toro and watched him for weeks put scenes together and be like, it's not working. It's not working. It's probably not going to work. Take it out of the movie. And then the last little thing clicks into place. Like,
yeah, it's perfect.
What was I so worried about? Like, it's hard to express the psychology that goes into being in the position you're in and that kind of mental, I don't know the right word, like fortitude and belief in yourself you have to have.
Yeah. There's a lot of trust that you have to instill in the team, of course.
Yeah.
A lot of it's about keeping a cool head. But, you know, I think being able to detach yourself from the stress of it is not like a skill. I think it's only by virtue of knowing how the tools work. If I was a director doing this spot and I didn't have any experience in 3D or I didn't have any, you know, I didn't have any inside knowledge on like how the post process works, I would have been stressed out of my mind for the whole job. But, you know, I know that every time we see a play blast or every time we see a render frame or a temp comp, you know, I know that where it's at. And I think that helps to alleviate a lot of worry and a lot of anxiety from the job. But that's not on every job, I suppose.
I've been amazed working with directors or honestly like agencies where I have a lot of empathy for them because they don't have that language. You know, like I can't tell you how many times, I'm sure you've run into this, where you show someone a play blast or a gray box kind of just like sim and you can see the worry come across their face for like, this isn't what it's going to look like, right? You're like, I don't know how I could live with that responsibility, not even understanding what stage of development everything is. That always, I feel bad. I feel a lot of like pain for people having to live in that and then just be like, do you just spend your whole time holding your breath until the day it ships? You're like, okay, we got through another one.
Yeah. We had a similar issue on the job with the giant furry monster made of all the furries. Like I remember the producer, we were all on the call and producer A says to producer B, look, you know, the first time we see that may actually be the only, when we deliver the thing. Yeah. And, you know, producer two goes, that's not going to work for me. And we were like, how about a play blast?
let's go to school.
Yeah.
I you know what? I wonder sometimes if that's actually, if you can do it in a way that's not condescending, if there's a way to like in a very trusty like situation where people all trust you, like be able to do that. Like, hey, let me show you how my process is going to work so you don't get scared. Mm. Here's from a previous job I've done. Here's the, you know, storyboard. Here's previs. It looks weird, but let me just show you one-to-one, like just literally scrub or flipbook it. Like, here's where it landed. So like, just so you know, it'll get there. Because I feel like a lot of people in that position don't want to show that they don't understand it.
Yeah.
But if you could find a way, like building that trust could be like your superpower.
Yeah, yeah. Again, it's kind of down to like communication, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you can find like a shorthand with the people you're working with for that stuff, I think it's a lot of, I mean, I will say a lot of the times nowadays, people have become a lot more trusting, I think, where they're kind of like, hey, we know this is your thing and we trust that you're going to get it across the line. So
that's great.
You know, go for it. And like I said earlier on, it's like, I think they wanted somebody who, for this job in particular, who they knew wouldn't let any stone go unturned. You know, it's like you need somebody in your camp who's going to be obsessed with the end product as you are, you know?
Well, I could have talked to you forever. I want to ask you two more questions.
Please.
What about Apple, this piece? What was the most difficult shot or the shot that kept you up at night? Because the range of things you're achieving in this, obviously beautiful live action, comping a lot of amazing stuff, that opening assembly, that's amazing. Doing a lot of character work. You're doing some shots with large crowds. You're trying to tell this whole story of like, hey, please trust us. Again, come back home. Was there a shot or a sequence or a moment that you were worried or not sure how it turned out that ended up being amazing?
Yes. specifically the stadium.
Yeah.
I was worried about the angle we were shooting the stadium at and how deep the crowd would go, if we were going to see repeats.
Right.
If we were, you know, the atmosphere in general of the stadium as well, the construction of the stadium. I wanted it to be futuristic, but I didn't want it to be unrealistic, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was also difficult to find somebody who had experience building something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of need someone who's like a designer, concept artist, but also an amazing modeler. You know, it was a tough one to find. And we did eventually find this guy who really knocked it out of the park. And I was really nervous about that shot before we got to it. And like, that was a shot with everything. It was a live action. It was a comp of a crowd. It mm-hmm. was a full CG character. It was like a holographic projection effect on top. It was atmospherics. It was, you know, crowd duplication in the background. It was complete CG environment. It was, you know, so it really had one of those shots where if anything doesn't go right, it can let the whole shot down.
Yeah.
And there was just so much that went into it. I was really happy with it in the end, but it was, that was one that I can see a couple of steps ahead, you know. I'm like, yeah, I know, you know, we'll put this here, this here, this here. That one I was like, oh, I think it's going to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're just taking the leap of faith. You build the team and set them up and cross your fingers.
Cross fingers, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it was beautiful though. I mean, it did such a great job of telling the end of the story. I mean, you didn't make it easy on yourself. There's some challenging camera angles. You know, like you're trying to sell multiple things. Like at the end of the day, you're still trying to get people to lean in and see what program is on that laptop.
Yes.
And understand that it's fast, but also the world, the celebration, the like vibe of it, you have to match all of that and maintain it. It's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like there's so many things that go into that, especially when it's the end shot, because you want it to be sort of the most impressive, you know, you want that story to keep kind of exponentially growing in excitement and growing mm-hmm. in vibrancy and intrigue. You know, you kind of save the best for last and a lot of that stuff. And so the kind of arc of that exponential curve of hype, you know, was something that we tried a lot of different ways to do it. And then, yeah, seeing the stuff on screen as well, like anything that we see on screen had to actively be on the actual screen, you know? So we had to screen record all that stuff.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
You play back on set. That's great. I love the, there's the match cut of the hologram character on the screen. Matching that sweep of the arm up to the next shot worked like chef's kiss there.
No, thank you. Yeah. So we actually, yeah, that wasn't even storyboarded at the, when we did that push in, I was like, it feels like we're just looking at our shins. It's not really that fun. Yeah. You know, I was like, why don't we do a whole thing? So that worked really well. And we had I can't remember the animator's name on it, but he was amazing. He had like great instincts with the scale of the character as well.
Yeah.
And while also keeping it very human.
Yeah, it's so hard to do, especially that up angle. It took 1.5 Transformers movies for that team to figure out what you got right in that shot. It was just the speed and the momentum and the how much energy it takes to get going, but how slow and how long it takes to come to a stop, but then also not feel mechanical, feel like a real person. There's a lot of sensitivity in that animation.
Yeah, yeah, big time. And all chopping it into whatever, 15 seconds of action.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I said I had two questions. That was an amazing answer to that one. Last one, separate from all of this stuff, you sit at the tip of the spear of a lot of different things, trends, dealing with clients, NFTs. Your website's full of great, really personal work. I'm wondering, we're at the end of the year. We're looking at another probably crazy year, maybe not as crazy as 2021, but out in the world, out on the horizon, the stuff you're obsessing on, you're researching, you're into, is there a tool or a piece of software or a technique that you just can't wait to get in your hands and find a project to apply it to?
Yeah, definitely. Real-time stuff, Unreal 5, mm-hmm. moving into, you know, because what's really interesting about Unreal 5 is that it's beginning to merge a lot of different things together. It's like currently a lot of the virtual production stuff is run on Unreal 4, but, mm-hmm. you know, that's just going to be even better in 5. Like I'm playing around with it today. That, you know, the integration of digital humans obviously mm-hmm. is amazing. The real-time engine's calling me this year, you know.
Yeah.
That's one of the places that I haven't really dipped in heavily enough yet. So that's definitely on the, and look, it looks amazing. Like, you know, just even playing around with it in the past 2 days, the sort of satisfaction you get from real-time lighting, real-time GI is just like, oh God, I've been waiting 15 years for this.
I'm glad you said that, because we do a end of the year podcast, and every year I'm like, this is the year of real-time. This is the year. And I really, it's very interesting how real-time engines have gone from being like middleware, basically, like, you know, like you have a team of artists and a team of programmers at a video game studio, and they need a way to stitch all the stuff together and throw it up. Middleware showed up. Like, here, license it. We'll do all the hard work for you. You just make the creative stuff, figure it out. But Unreal 5, probably because of a lot of the volume and the kind of like buzz around Mandalorian and all the other things, it's the first version of a real-time engine that feels like it's specifically for filmmakers. When you look at Nanite and Lumen and MetaHumans, all those checkboxes are getting ticked so fast that it almost seems insane not to, as a filmmaker, be diving into it.
Yeah. I even see some of my traditional director buddies really leaning into the virtual production stuff now, and just seeing how they can do 12 locations in a day on a stage.
It's insane.
You know, and at the same time, be able to capture a bunch of beautiful lights traveling over cars and you know, all the stuff that takes an age to set up when you're outdoors. You know, like you're just, you know, you don't have to put a car you don't have to, you know, rig an Alexa to the side of a Lexus anymore. You know, you just...
If I never have to see a bad process shot comp of people in a car with those halos and fringes around their hair ever again in my life, I would shoot in a virtual production every single time.
Right. Yeah.
Just for that.
Yeah. And I think it does this thing where it kind of integrates the worlds. I mean, the actual collaborative worlds of artists who are going to be real-time artists with on-set art directors and cinematographers. And it just, it glues that whole situation together. The thing of like shooting green screen and then keying it and handing it off to a, that whole situation is messy, and it does open up a lot of room for error, and it also elongates a process that, you know, it's very cumbersome and stuff. So I think like that, just having the ability to do virtual production and also have it as a design tool and an environment tool and all that other stuff is just great. So that's where my head is at this year. I'm really interested in kind of figuring it out and just trying to break it. You know, most of the stuff that I do, I just try to break the software. That's the fun bit.
Well, I think maybe this time next year, we're going to have you back on to see what your discoveries are and see how you break this stuff and how you push it, because it's so exciting seeing someone who has a foot in live action and a foot in motion design historically getting to be at the place you are when all this stuff is hidden at the same time. Like you're in rarefied air, but there's also a lot more to go. So we'll have to come back next year. Shane, can we get you on the record right now to have you come back?
Anytime you want me back.
Awesome, dude. Well, thank you very much. If you're listening to this right now, you know, this is the kind of conversation I love. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you want to hear from more people like Shane and Jim at Dimension, because it may not be your bread and butter After Effects and Cinema 4 conversation right now, but not too far in the future, these are the things we're all going to be thinking about. So thank you again, Shane. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Ryan. Pleasure. And thanks everybody for tuning in.
Okay. Who's excited about going and grabbing a camera, shooting some stuff, and adding some CG to it? I know what I'm going to do as soon as this recording's over. Well, let us know if you liked hearing from someone who lives in the world of motion design, but also likes to deal with live action. It's a untapped world for a lot of motion designers. Until the next one, we are always here to inspire you, to introduce you to new people, and just get you excited about every day you wake up as a motion designer. We'll see you soon. Peace.